Thank you. Please be seated. The court is ready to hear oral argument from petitioners in Helena v. Wilkins.
May it please the court, petitioners
have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal. May it please the court, the respondents, the Wilkins, claim that the Cherokee brand grain sorting seed that they purchased from the petitioner, Helena Chemical Company, did not perform as warranted or represented, and that they suffered lost profits in their farming operations as a result. The Wilkins received a $360,000 verdict from the Starr County jury. Trial court entered judgment on the verdict. Court of Appeals affirmed in a split 2-1 decision. I intend to focus on the point concerning the Seed Arbitration Act and, time permitting, on the no evidence points regarding causation and damages. The Seed Arbitration Act creates a special arbitration mechanism for one claiming to have been damaged as a result of failure of seed to perform, and is prerequisite, in the words of the statute, to any suit based on such a claim. The claimant must, before going to court, submit the case to arbitration before the State Seed and Plant Board, which is a board comprised of neutral experts. The board is to investigate, and to ensure a good investigation, the board, the claimant, according to the statute, must file the arbitration within the time necessary to allow effective inspection of the plants in field conditions. The findings and conclusions of the board are not binding, but in any subsequent litigation may be introduced into evidence to assist the finder of fact. As the majority of the opinion in the Court of Appeals noted, there are two benefits that the legislature had in mind with this provision. One, to provide a potential avenue of settlement, and two, to provide information from an unbiased body of experts to guide the finder of fact in the often particularly complex area of the interaction between seed and various environmental and cultivation factors that all go into determining how a crop comes out. And the Wilkins failed to invoke the arbitration procedures before filing suit, despite the fact that one of the Wilkins, a practicing attorney, admittedly was aware of the requirement. And also, as required by law, the arbitration requirement is set forth on every seed bag that Helena sells. On Helena's motion, after the lawsuit was filed, the trial court compelled the case to arbitration before the seed board. Wilkins waited 16 months after that order to begin to file the arbitration. And the State Seed and Plant Board ruled that the arbitration was filed too late at that point to permit the effective inspection according to field conditions as required by the statute, and therefore declined to arbitrate.
Isn't there evidence in the record that Helena Chemical tried to persuade the plaintiffs not to engage in the arbitration process?
Slim to none, Your Honor. The only evidence on that point whatsoever is Defendant's Exhibit 45, which is a letter of August 1994. This was a harvest that took place in the summer of 1994. And Mr. Wilkins' August letter, and this is the only evidence at all on that point, says, "I am mindful that the code requires arbitration. I believe Mr. Yoff, a Helena representative, earlier suggested to my secretary that he was interested, in mediation. And I am not sure if that was a suggestion that we forego statutory arbitration." That's the only evidence on that point anywhere in the record. Mr. Wilkins, the author of the letter himself, did not testify. Your Honor, that is hardly enough to meet the requirements of estoppel, even as of August of 94, a false representation made with knowledge to someone who doesn't have means to acquire the knowledge and acting on it to one's detrimental reliance.
Does a refusal of the board to arbitrate always deprive the trial court of jurisdiction under your interpretation of the statute?
Certainly, if it's because the case has not been filed in time as required by the statute, and which is the case here, and I can't.
Well, I mean, under your interpretation of the statute, we have a refusal to arbitrate.
Yes.
And your position is that even though that's not a decision by the arbitration board, we in fact didn't get to arbitrate.
That's correct.
I mean, it was never arbitrated. So
yes,
we've had actually never had an opportunity then in the arbitration proceeding to go through it, make fact findings, even if the plaintiff loses, because there's no evidence now that we can't inspect. We haven't had an arbitration.
That's right.
And my question to you is that given your how you would have us interpret the statute, wouldn't that lead to the result that if, for whatever reason, the arbitration board decides not to arbitrate or refuses to arbitrate, then that is effective to deprive the trial court of jurisdiction? If we interpret the statute your way, isn't that the result?
I think so, Your Honor, and certainly in this case where it's not filed timely. Now, maybe if the arbitration board
had no good reason.
No,
I understand, but I'm just looking at the logical implications of the construction that you would have us put on the statute.
That is correct, Your Honor, and I think that's justified by the language in the statute saying it must be filed in time to permit effective inspection.
Okay,
where does the statute say that the plaintiff, that arbitration is a prerequisite to a lawsuit?
Your Honor, that is in 64.002, Part A. When a purchaser of seed designed for planting claims to have been damaged by the failure of the seed to produce or perform as represented by warranty or label, the purchaser must submit the claim to arbitration as provided in this chapter as a prerequisite to the exercise of the purchaser's right to maintain a legal action.
Going back to your earlier point, doesn't it say that in 64005 that the board shall conduct arbitration as provided by this chapter?
Yes.
And if they're to do it as provided by that chapter, does that mean that they have to do it within the time necessary to permit effective inspection of the plants?
Yes, Your Honor.
But where does it say effective inspection of plants by the arbitration board? Why can't it be by independent third party?
The statute, and I'm not sure I can point to it real quickly, says that the inspection is to be by the board or a member of the board. And
but in this particular case, that wouldn't matter at all because the arbitration was filed in 96 and the effective inspection of the plants terminated in 93 and 94.
That's correct, Your
Honor. Well, but again, the question is effective inspection by whom?
But the point is there's no one here who could have inspected the plants
while they
were in field condition.
You're correct, Justice Abbott, that at that point it couldn't have been inspected by anyone. But there is a provision, Justice O'Neill, and I can't put my hand on it right now, but it's in the statute that says that the inspection is to be by the board or one of its members. There's nothing that allows any delegation to somebody else.
On that point, there's nothing in the statute that says the arbitrating panel can refuse to arbitrate. There's a timeliness issue, correct? And the timeliness issue, as best I can read it, is because you have to have something to review.
That's correct.
But in 64004, the commission has the authority to make findings about why it can't decide the facts in the case based on the failure to do things timely. Now, if we're going to interpret the statute to say that it is a requisite to filing suit, if you don't arbitrate, you can't file suit. The statute contemplates that there might be a circumstance where the arbitration panel is unable to make a decision because timeliness is an issue or they just can't, based on the facts that are available to them, they can't make it. Does the arbitration panel then have the authority to refuse to arbitrate in such a way that then the parties are deprived of the right to go to court?
Well, I think certainly in this case where the complaint was not filed within the time necessary to permit effective field inspection as required by the statute, then certainly they were within their authority and I think compelled to refuse to arbitrate.
Well, Mr. Murray, now what would the result have been any different? Let's say that everyone shows up for the arbitration and because they couldn't do their inspection and everything was there and the board says, well, obviously we don't have any evidence here. So as a result, instead of refusing to arbitrate, they made specific findings. No evidence of problems with the seeds because an inspection couldn't be conducted and therefore no one can prove one way or the other what was going on. Let's say that they went through that and they made specific findings based on the fact that there was no evidence because they couldn't do an inspection. Would that have satisfied the prerequisite to suit language that's contained in the statute?
If I understand your hypothetical correctly, Your Honor, you're talking about a situation as here where they couldn't arbitrate because it wasn't filed timely.
Exactly.
It was too late to
inspect. Exactly. I mean, the point is that they show up for the arbitration proceeding, and because they waited this period of time and they couldn't do the inspections, basically you have a hearing where there's a failure on a burden of proof. And, in fact, findings can be made on it. We are unable to find, you know, we don't find this because we couldn't do the inspection. There's no evidence of this because the crops are all gone now, and so no one can inspect it to see. Therefore, we conclude that the seed company wins. Let's say that these exact facts were resolved by that kind of an order rather than this was delayed and we refused to arbitrate. Under those circumstances, has the prerequisite to suit language been satisfied sufficient to give the trial court jurisdiction?
Your Honor, I don't think the board would be within, would be...
No, that's not my question. That's not my question. My question is, if their order had read differently, instead of saying, we're not going to arbitrate because too much time has passed, and instead said, we're here to arbitrate, and by gosh, no one's able to put on evidence of anything, and we make specific findings as we are required to make, and the seed company wins this arbitration. May have been caused by the delay because we can't inspect. But we actually have a determination in favor of the seed company that resulted from the delay. Does that satisfy the prerequisite to sue, sufficient to trigger jurisdiction?
I think not, because I think they violated the statute, because the statute says you've got to file within the time necessary to prevent...
No, but the language that you say is that they have to submit the claim as a prerequisite to the exercise of the purchaser's right to maintain an action. And
yes.
Your position is it was never arbitrated.
But it also says, Your Honor, in 64.006 that the complaint and arbitration must be filed within the time necessary to permit the effective inspection. So if it wasn't filed in that time, our position is the seed board has no authority other than to decline the arbitration, which is what it did, and the prerequisite is not
satisfied. So how do we justify that then with Section 34.004, which will allow the trial court to take into account any findings of the Board of Arbitration with respect to the failure of any party to cooperate in the arbitration proceedings, including any finding as to the effect of delay in filing the arbitration claim or the Board's ability to determine the facts? That sounds like just exactly our circumstance that I just explained.
Not for this reason.
Okay.
The argument you suggest is the one that was the majority opinion in the Court of Appeals. I think the dissent is much more persuasive. The dissent first points to the language in 64.004, the introductory clause there, that says, in any litigation involving a complaint that has been the subject of arbitration under this chapter, the party may introduce the report. And then it goes on to say, the language you were reading, findings about delay, et cetera, but that's only in any litigation involving a complaint that has been the subject of arbitration.
Well,
this one was never the subject of arbitration because it was filed too late.
I want to know where the board has the authority to make the decision that we refuse to arbitrate, and as a result of refusing to arbitrate, regardless of the reason why, then we in effect are able to make the decision whether anyone goes to court or not. I mean, where is the authority in the statute that says we can choose to say we're not going to arbitrate this one? Is there any place in here that gives him that authority?
I think that is necessarily implied by the provision
okay.
that the arbitration must be filed
okay,
in
but,
time
but,
to
but there is no provision in here that says the board can refuse to arbitrate if you don't timely file.
There is no explicit provision.
Well, is it implied, though, in 64.005? Where it says that the board shall conduct the arbitration as provided by this chapter, and it's provided in this chapter that the arbitration must be filed at a time that allows the panel to inspect it, the plants while in field condition.
That's correct. And our position would be, and if it's not filed by that time, then the board has no choice but to decline, which is what
Well, then how would we ever get to the point where we would ever give any meaningful language in 64.004 about the fact that the court can consider delay and the effect of the delay on the board's ability to determine the facts. How could we ever get to that point?
In this circumstance, Your Honor, the complaint is timely filed. It's still possible to have a field inspection, but it's not possible to have as good an inspection as it would have been had there not been delay and it had been filed earlier, so the conclusions are somewhat hazier than they would otherwise be.
And how much time in the statute do they have to file the arbitration?
Within such time as is necessary to permit an effective inspection according to the
condition. We don't have an absolute time period.
There's not a bright line.
So since there's no bright line in this, then why wouldn't we be looking for the board to make findings for example, a finding that it was necessary that this was filed too late for us to be able to do our inspection and stuff? Why don't we actually have an arbitration decision that makes that determination?
Well, that's a conclusion they made, but it wasn't an arbitration finding because they declined to arbitrate.
I know, but see, that's the vicious cycle that I see people getting caught. I'm just trying to reconcile these provisions. Obviously, the Court of Appeals had some difficulty because there's a dissenting opinion. And so I'm trying to reconcile the two things. It sounds like a very vicious cycle here, and I'm trying to figure out how we break out of it.
And I think the only way to do it, Your Honor, and I think it's supported by the language of 64004, is to read 64004 as only pertaining to claims that have been the subject of arbitration. Since this one was not the subject of arbitration,
because
it was too late, then 64004
does not
apply.
Why don't we have a decision from the board that says we make findings that we're unable to decide because it was too late for us to inspect, and therefore actually have an arbitration decision?
Well, they certainly concluded that it was too late because it wasn't filed timely. They didn't make arbitration findings because of that reason.
Your argument, if I understand your argument, the arbitration board could have arbitrated this claim. They could have advised the court that because of the lateness in filing it, we cannot determine the facts of this case, therefore we can't render a decision. Now, hear me out.
Yes.
So, they could have done this. But your response to that, had they done that, is that the arbitration panel did not have jurisdiction to do so because the arbitration was not filed in the time to do the inspect it under field conditions. That's your fallback position.
Almost, Your Honor. Our position is the board, having concluded that it wasn't timely filed because you could no longer inspect under field conditions, then had no choice but to decline to arbitrate because the statute says it must be filed.
I'm sorry. If the board concludes that, then it sounds to me like it's arbitrating. It's making a decision. But your argument is if they had accepted this to make a decision that they are unable to, if they had accepted this and done findings about the inability to reach the facts, determine the facts in this case, they would not have had jurisdiction to do so because the filing would have had to have been timely so that they could inspect it under field conditions.
That's right. And if a determination that the finding is not timely is somehow regarded as an arbitration itself, then that's a loophole that eviscerates the statute because any plaintiff with a shaky case who doesn't want a neutral panel of experts could simply delay until the last minute and avoid the entire effect of the statute.
The flip side of that argument, if the timeliness of field conditions is not a jurisdictional issue for the arbitration panel, if it's not a jurisdictional issue for the arbitration panel, then the arbitration panel's determination of the lack of timeliness would be a decision on the merits, either to refuse it or to go ahead and have and take nothing because they're unable to determine the facts.
I think that's right. I think it did not have jurisdiction to do anything other than what it did.
Any other questions? Thank you. The court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. Skaggs will present argument for the respondents.
I think it's probably ironic that I may well, though I opposed having this thing brought up for review, that I may be the reason that we're here, because I think I made a comment, I know I did in the briefing, that if it is not already the policy of the state that the Seaboard can use outside investigations than it ought to be. And I think I challenge the court to go ahead and make that part of the law of this state if that's going to be dispositive.
We're here dealing with the statute.
Yes, ma'am.
I want to follow up on Justice Hankinson's and Justice Enoch's questions. It seems to me, just looking at the statute, that the legislature was trying to make happen was to have an independent third party, Texas Tech, University of Texas, people look at the crop out in the field and make findings, and then the jury and the court, in some cases, would have the benefit of that. Is that the purpose of this act?
I think it probably is.
Now, how is that purpose carried forward if we were to allow a plaintiff who says, you know, I really don't want an independent analysis by the University of Texas and Texas Tech. I want to wait 2 or 3 years to bring my claim and let the jury decide, and I just do not have the independent analysis. I want my third-party expert. Now, if we rule for you, isn't that effectively what we're saying?
Well, in our situation, I don't think that that has that effect, but I think you're right.
In your situation, that is exactly the effect.
Pardon?
In your situation, that is exactly the effect.
Well,
because in your situation, we don't have an independent analysis undertaken by independent authority. Instead, what we're confined to is competing expert testimony, and that is exactly what the legislature was trying to get away. So this case is a quintessential example of what the legislature was trying to avoid.
Sure, but without a binding result, what difference does it make?
They didn't make it a binding result because what they wanted to do was to try to encourage a very expeditious resolution based upon an independent expert.
Which I think it encourages. I think it does encourage an expeditious examination of the facts by a disinterested third party.
Well, in this case, they waited 2 years to even file a lawsuit.
Well, in this case also, we were in a position where we were still negotiating with the other side well into Christmas, which is way beyond the point.
This seems kind of bogus in a sense. Let's kind of dismiss that real quick. If you're a lawyer and you have cases maybe that bump up against the statute of limitations, are you not going to go ahead and file the lawsuit if you're undertaking negotiations with the other side? Maybe you keep talking for a few more months, a few more years, and then without any hard, fast agreements extending the statute of limitations, you'll file your lawsuit later and then say, well, golly gee, they were negotiating with me.
Well, and let me comment. I want to answer the question, but let me comment on this. Is that the statute itself has a tolling provision.
In that regard, tolling once the complaint for arbitration has been filed.
Sure, exactly. You and I are talking about the same thing. My recollection about when this was filed, I was the trial lawyer in the case, too. Unlike a lot of people who come and argue in front of you, I had this from the dirt, with no pun intended. My recollection is that by the time we got the problem happened in July, or the second problem happened in July, by the time December-ish came around, 5 months approximately, and it became very obvious that we were not going to get a resolution done at that point. The plants were gone. And then by February, which would have been 2 months later, was when we actually filed the lawsuit. And my recollection is that we were dealing with, and I may be wrong about this, but I think this lawsuit was either filed within 8 months of the final problem or within 20, but didn't bump right up against the statute.
Isn't the purpose of the statute to require an inspection before the plants are gone?
Sure, I think it is. Which makes sense, of course, because if you're having to rely on just what somebody said, that would be something entirely different. But in this case, we have, and as would be the case in many cases, we have analysis by outside third parties, soil analysis, plant analysis, photographic evidence, things that the board could rely on, aside from the opinions of people's respective experts. Heck, we even have the breeder out there, the guy who, in essence,
plant. Again, we're dealing with the statutory language, and that's where I'm having a hard time getting around this. You could have continued negotiations while the board was conducting this arbitration.
There
was nothing. So why didn't you follow the statute in 94 when you had crop problems in 94? Not just 95, but 94. Why didn't you call up the board and say, we want an arbitration team out here, come do your independent investigation? And then you wouldn't have had these problems. Then the jury would have been able to have findings from this independent source that they could take into account.
I agree with that. And I can't comment on what happened before I got involved in the lawsuit or in the claim. I was involved after the plants. I had nothing I could go see by the time I was hired.
And nothing that the arbitrators could do.
And nothing that the arbitrators could see other than the evidence that both sides had preserved, the soil sampling and so forth.
Isn't a reasonable construction of the Act that the language that Justice Enoch was asking about on the delay. It deals with once the arbitration is timely initiated and there's some delay for some reason in getting in evidence, or maybe perhaps the arbitration was filed in July when the plants are about to be harvested versus March when they're...
Sure.
Is that a reasonable construction of the statute to deal with the timeliness issue?
And I don't follow you. Perhaps I wasn't. I may have been looking at something else when
The language in the section that says the arbitrators may advise the court on what effect timeliness had on its analysis. Isn't a reasonable construction of that statute that you bring a timely arbitration, but it may be too late, or the crop may have been damaged to such a point that there still may be issues that the arbitration panel can't resolve, even though they're looking at the crop in the field?
Sure, and I can also propose other reasonable interpretations for that part of the statute. One thing is, it's not up to the board to make a comment about the delay. It's up to the judge in the case, as I recall from the statute we can look at it, but it's up to the judge in the case, the trial level judge, to consider in his own discretion about the effects of the delay and whether it made any difference. In this case, Judge Pope, who was the trial judge in Starr County, looked at it and said that he didn't think it, obviously felt like he didn't think it made any difference because he kept it on the docket. There was a motion made to dismiss the case at the time of trial, or prior to trial, while we were in pretrial matters, and Judge Pope overruled it.
But that's the issue we're here on. I mean, isn't the issue, can't the legislature validly say you've got to go through this process while the crops are in the field? Otherwise, you can't bring a lawsuit. Don't they have that authority?
Well, let me, I don't want to dodge your question, but let me make this comment. It doesn't say you can't bring a lawsuit. It says you can't maintain your cause of action. Bringing the lawsuit, I don't want to get down that road where we get into those kind of statutes or municipal liability statutes where you don't send a 60-day notice letter, for example, under somebody's city ordinances that you can't sue them. It is not a question of
I stand corrected. Can't the legislature validly say that you can't maintain your legal action unless you get this independent team out there while the crops are in the field?
Of course they can. They're the legislature.
And isn't that what they said?
They said it. Well, you're going to lead me down into the defenses that we have to why we didn't feel like we had any obligation to be cooperating with an arbitration process, which had to do with, and if you want to get into it, we can, or we can wait until that's appropriate.
I'm just focusing on whether
the particular provisions of this statute pertain to the particular cause of action we had under deceptive trade practices, which I don't think it did. I mean, by the time I got hold of it, the plants were dead and gone. I opposed the motion to arbitrate. Motion to abate and compel arbitration based on the fact that it is based on things that have to do with seed labeling, has to do with negligence, and has to do with warranty. Our cause of action was under the DTPA, under unconscionability and under false or deceptive acts or practices. We allege the other things.
Assuming pieces, at least, of your cause of action fell within the statute, weren't you compelled to bring an arbitration within that time period of the field were still in place before you could maintain your legal action?
That was an argument that was made by opposing counsel at the time of the hearing. I opposed it. I don't think we had, was it Havner or was it Gamble that finally, when we finally got some clarification about whether if you have a component of a cause of action, related facts, that you might be compelled to go and arbitrate everything at the same time? Which is, of course, the court's interpretation of common law, this court's interpretation, and you are the Supreme Court. You can say that, and that is the law. But if the legislature excludes, and in fact, this is where we get into kind of a Fleming and Fitzgerald, I guess, analysis on whether we've got an ambiguous statute or not, and then in trying to figure out what the intent of the legislature was. But in 64003, the legislature, in the actual language of the statute, when they tell you what you have to put in your seed label, refers to it as maintaining certain legal actions.
So you're not arguing that the statute requires you to bring negligence and warranty claims before the crops go out of the field, or you're out of court. You're just saying that it, since you brought a DTPA action, this doesn't apply to you at all.
Well, yeah. Yes. But you're saying, had it been based on negligence, I think that with all the other considerations, of course, that we haven't even gotten to yet, I think we probably would have been in a position where we had to get to those plans, because clearly the statute, if it's based on negligence or the seed label or actual asserted warranty, then that's real clear in 6402. That's in the first four lines of the statute.
So you say you lose on those claims?
Well, I lost on those anyway. The jury didn't go with me on those. We didn't submit negligence. We didn't submit seed label. We did submit warranty, and they did give us that. But there are a number of reasons why, as an alternative grounds of relief, I would have relied on warranty anyway. If I had only one warranty and we didn't even have this statute to worry about, I think I'd be having some real problems right now on a warranty claim if that was all I got from the jury. But I didn't. I got the DTPA.
Okay, well, you may be shifting us in a different direction then. So what you're saying is that if your claims are based upon warranty, the seed label, or negligence, then even though you really kind of don't want to, you may be willing to say, well, maybe the statutory prerequisite of filing for arbitration may make your claim not look all that strong.
No, I would think so, if those were.
But what
that's
saying,
where I went.
Okay, what you're saying is those aren't your claims.
But those aren't my
claims. You're suing for something else.
Sure.
And that you're entitled to pursue those other claims.
Yes.
Okay.
Mr., explain to me what a trial looks like if you actually have an arbitration and you have a report done as a result of the arbitration proceeding. It's a non-binding decision. It's a report based on the investigation that's conducted by the board. You go to trial.
Right.
Does anything preclude either party from bringing in their own experts or being able to do their own investigation during the course of the proceeding? That's just something that can be put into evidence and considered by the fact finder at the point in time the case is resolved.
That's correct.
Let me ask you, I haven't looked at the chart. Under the statute, if you try this case to a jury, does the charge contemplate that there are instructions by the judge on the judge's viewpoint of, say, the fact that this was delayed and so the arbitration board didn't make a decision?
I don't know. I really don't.
Or do you just offer into evidence whatever they said and the jury gets to draw whatever conclusion they want to for and against somebody?
I do not have a clue how you do that. I've thought about that a lot.
Well, you know, I was just thinking about whether it's somewhat akin to some of these types of workers' compensation litigation where you get to the district court and the jury or the fact finder gets to look at the previous award and see what happened there, whether that's a similar situation here.
You know, the interesting, I don't know if it's a similar situation. The interesting and odd thing about it is, and the reason it's so hard to answer is because it says that the court may give such weight, the court, not the finder of fact, may give such weight to whatever the arbitration board does as he sees.
Yeah, I understand it. That's what prompted my question. It doesn't say anything about, like, fact finder, which would make it a broader opportunity for a jury to view those things. And then something just comes to mind is that they can judge, the court can judge the weight. How can they instruct the jury when they're not supposed to comment on the weight of the evidence?
Well, and then even beyond that, it allows either party to introduce the findings of the board into evidence. It doesn't appear to give any discretion to the court to exclude the finding by the board. And, you know, where you go with that, I assume that if I wanted arbitration, I'd want to get it in and he wouldn't. And if he wanted arbitration, he'd want to get it in and I wouldn't. And then it would just be in evidence along with everything else.
Was there evidence during the court? I'm trying to figure out how this plays out just in the real world, because
sure,
I've never been involved in one of these. During the trial of this matter, was there any testimony offered and then admitted or refused on the fact that this case was not submitted to the arbitration board in time for them to do the inspection, and in fact there was no report available? Was any of that raised during the course of the trial proceedings?
Judge, I can't answer that question because of flaw in memory, and Mr. Murray is going to have the benefit of being able to look through his record, before he gets back up, and he may be able to answer it. I know that it did come up, in pretrial motions. I'm reasonably sure, well, I know that we marked the actual letter from the board as evidence, but I don't remember if that went to the jury or it was a court's exhibit only. We had a court's exhibit only in the case, and I just don't remember it. It may have been one of our DTPA epistles or something like that.
Okay, well, I mean, you don't recall Mr. Wilkins being questioned, like, you know, you realize that you didn't get there in time to get an independent inspection, and so now the jury doesn't have the benefit of this or anything to that effect, or anyone from the seed company being questioned about the fact that they were deprived of this independent investigation. You don't recall that being a subject?
I don't think that ever came up in front of the jury. I don't think that ever came up actually in pretrial, what you just said.
Okay.
Are you familiar with the fact that the statute is based upon Florida law?
No, I wasn't.
So you're not familiar with the Ferry & Moore Seed Company case from the Supreme Court of Florida?
No, but if you tell me what you think it says, I like it, I'll agree with you.
I don't think you'll like it, but I don't want to waste time on that. Now, let me ask you about something else. You say that your claims are not warranty claims, seed label claims, or negligence claims. Instead, they're the DTPA, the unconscionability, and those things. My first question is, what is your response to the petitioner's claim, as they say in the brief, that a warranty includes, quote, any affirmation of fact or promise which relates to the goods and becomes a part of the basis of the bargain, citing Texas Business and Commerce Code? The point being that even though your claim is not one for breach of warranty, your claim falls within the broader definition of what that means in the Business and Commerce Code, and therefore should go the same way as a breach of warranty claim would go.
Sure, and that's an obvious question to come up. I certainly see where you're going on that. It's, you know, it's something we've been wrestling at the trial level with for years. And in fact, came up when we were preparing the charge here. You've got common law warranty, you've got statutory warranty under the UCC, and then you've got that thing that the DTPA calls warranty. And how are they different, and how are they the same? There have been some report decisions on it, but it hasn't gone nearly far enough where we have a real clear view of it. I had alternative submissions prepared to give the trial judge about the wording of warranty under one statute, the wording of warranty under the other. I can't dispute what you just said about what he says the definition of warranty is under the UCC.
Well, then let me ask you this.
Okay.
Which claims do you assert fall outside the parameters of what I'm about to read to you?
Yes.
Any affirmation of fact or promise which relates to the goods and becomes a part of the basis of the bargain. Which claims have you asserted that fall outside the scope of that?
I really even highlighted it before I got up here, so you didn't catch me by surprise. False, misleading, or deceptive act of practice under the DTPA. One of the three, that was in the charge, and in fact, it would have been question number one. One of the three definitions that we utilize, of course there are lots of them, and a lot of them had to do with used cars and things that would never even come up in this, but the third one that was, I apologize, I don't know which subsection this actually matches to in the statute, but it's the failing to disclose information about Cherokee seed that was known at the time of the transaction with the intention to induce the plaintiffs into a transaction they otherwise would not have entered into had the information been disclosed.
And the Court of Appeals found there was no evidence of that.
No, I don't think they did. If they did, I'm certainly take issue with that. I'm not taking issue with what you're saying. I just don't recall it that way. And if that's how they feel, I'm certainly willing to discuss that based on a lot of factual information. I believe they've overlooked something, if that's actually in their opinion.
What were you just reading from?
I was reading from the court's, from the court's charge, and that was question number one.
One's really the only one you hang your hat on in this court, right?
Well, not necessarily. We're going to need to get some direction from the Texas Supreme Court about the distinction between UCC warranty and DTPA warranty. If I'm going to stand here and concede that I don't have a if a representation under the DTPA really is warranted, and if they, and if that's different from, you realize, of course, that that warranty is a separate enumerated basis for liability under the DTPA.
Well,
there's a separate place for warranty.
In both questions 1 and 3, you include express warranties other than the DTPA warranty.
I'm sorry.
In both questions 1 and 3,
yes,
you ask the jury about express warranties that are other than the DTPA warranty.
And these come right out of the DTPA. 1 and 3 are actually laundry list. Well, 1 is laundry list items, and then 2 is the unconscionable action. 3 is whatever we decided we were submitting under warranty, and I couldn't tell you now whether we were submitting UCC warranty or DTPA warranty.
At least
I don't remember which way we jumped on
the
that.
The first two definitions of under question 1 of what a warranty is also fit within the UCC.
That's where we're going to need some guidance.
And assuming
if that's the case, I don't disagree with what your colleague has read to me. I don't disagree with what Mr. Murray has said the general definition of warranty is. I don't see any law in the state that says warranty in this context under this statute is exactly the same thing as warranty under some other statute. I don't know. I don't know the answer.
But if this only cuts off some causes of action,
right?
Because arbitration has not been done, it would not be very effective. Because you could sue under products law, you could sue for fraud as you did, you could sue DTPA.
Well, if that's what the legislature did.
But I just asked, it wouldn't be very effective in achieving its purpose if it was just limited to a few actions.
Probably not. Yeah. If that's what they intended to do.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Skaggs, this is a I'm sorry, Mr. Murray. This is a non-binding procedure.
It is.
And also, you don't have any reason to dispute that, excuse me, in the type of dispute that might arise between a purchaser of seed and a seller of seed, that there could be causes of action at common law that arise from the transaction.
Yes.
Right? Okay, now, if that's the case, and as a purchaser of seed, I have a common law cause of action, and I am required to submit it to a non-binding arbitration procedure, that if I fail to comply with the statute, cuts off my right to go to court. Why doesn't that interpretation of the statute lead to constitutional problems vis-a-vis open courts? Because I have cause of action at common law. I never got it litigated any place in a binding forum. And now I am precluded from taking that common law cause of action to court. Why doesn't your, help me through that.
Of course, constitutionality has not been raised.
But I'm concerned about the implications of the decision, and we have to interpret statutes in a way that render them constitutional. And what the question after listening to the discourse throughout the morning leads me to wonder why your interpretation couldn't lead to, in fact, cutting off someone from access to the courts for resolution of a claim of common law, which the open courts provision of the Constitution of Texas prohibits the legislature from doing.
Your Honor, I suggest that it's not any different than this court's decision in the Jack Anglin case, where you had contractual claims and you had misrepresentation claims. And the contractual claims were subject to an arbitration agreement.
But they were subject to a binding arbitration.
Subject to a binding arbitration agreement, and the misrepresentation claims, common law misrepresentation claims, were not. And the court said because those claims are all factually intertwined, it all has to go to arbitration.
If a party has agreed to go to arbitration, has contracted because that's part of the transaction that they have entered into with the opposing party, and in fact the result is a binding decision where in fact they have basically by contract chosen to litigate their matter in a private, quote, private forum as opposed to courts, that's a very different circumstance than a situation that cuts off access to the courts for a common law cause of action by statute, not by agreement, and that would only lead to a non-binding report in any event. So I don't see England as being the same. Get to the heart of that. I've pointed out a couple of things. Common law, non-binding, no contract, statute. Smells of open courts problems, doesn't it?
Respectfully, Your Honor, I think England does answer it because there the person agreed only to arbitrate their contract claims, not their common law misrepresentation claims, yet because they were factually intertwined, as they are here.
All right.
But they were cut off from the whole thing.
But, factual distinction, parties agreed to do that. This is the legislature, by statute, saying this is what has to happen. It's legislative action that, in fact, gives rise to open courts issues, not the question of what parties I understand the intertwined argument, but that's a case where there's a contractual arrangement that's been made and the parties have agreed to it. This is legislative action that a purchaser of seed has not consented to in connection with the purchase, has not agreed to, or whatever, and in fact it also leads to a non-binding decision. So why don't we have the legislature cutting off access to the courts for common law causes of action if we interpret the statute the way that you say?
Well first of all, I don't think it matters that it's non-binding. It is non-binding, but we were robbed of the right to have guidance from the seed board. And I simply don't think it's any different than the person who got cut off from his common law misrepresentation claims in Jack Angle.
Well, but you're not the claimant. You're not the claimant, though. I'm talking about a claimant who is guaranteed access to the courts. You're the one who's you're saying you were denied access to arbitration. I'm talking about whether or not there's a denial, which doesn't exist under the Constitution. I'm talking about denial of access to the courts. So what's at issue here is the fact that you're saying that a plaintiff cannot have access to the courts. And my question to you is, why doesn't that create open courts problems for the plaintiff, the purchaser of seed?
Well, the only reason he's cut off from the court is because he didn't timely follow the procedure set out in the statute. Why is that any different, Your Honor, than a DTP?
He has not consented to in connection with the purchase, has not agreed to, or whatever. And, in fact, it also leads to a non-binding decision. So why don't we have the legislature cutting off access to the courts for common law causes of action if we interpret the statute the way that you say?
Well first of all, I don't think it matters that it's non-binding. It is non-binding, but we were robbed of the right to have guidance from the seed board. And I simply don't think it's any different than the person who got cut off from his common law misrepresentation claims in Jack Angle.
Well, but you're not the claimant. You're not the claimant, though. I'm talking about a claimant who is guaranteed access to the courts. You're the one who's you're saying you were denied access to arbitration. I'm talking about whether or not there's a denial, which doesn't exist under the Constitution. I'm talking about denial of access to the courts. So what's at issue here is the fact that you're saying that a plaintiff cannot have access to the courts. And my question to you is, why doesn't that create open courts problems for the plaintiff, the purchaser of seed?
Well, the only reason he's cut off from the court is because he didn't timely follow the procedure set out in the statute. Why is that any different, Your Honor, than a DTPA letter or other requirements that are accredited?
Because that's a statutory cause of action.
To a lawsuit.
That's a statutory cause of action. I'm talking common law causes of action.
That's my next question.
Judge Abbott had a question.
Okay, I'm sorry. Does it make a difference with regard to that question that the seeds packaged on themselves that were purchased by the farmer had the arbitration agreement on there and the prerequisite that, in fact, here's exactly what it says. On the seed package itself, did it not say that arbitration is required as a precondition of maintaining certain legal actions?
Yes, in various states, including Texas.
Is that tantamount to a contract entered into by the seed purchaser.
I think it is, and it's also, of course, required by the statute.
Do you know that there's an attorney general's opinion that says this statute does not violate the open court's provision?
I was not aware of it.
Judge Baker.
But my question was the argument made by opposing counsel that, as I understand it, his DTPA action is outside the scope of this act, and it was submitted to the jury, and it will support his judgment, aside from all of the discourse on the act.
And our response to that is twofold, Your Honor. First of all, all of these claims are factually intertwined. They're all based on statements like, this is good seed, or it has excellent dry land potential. And furthermore, all of his causes of action, whether warranty or DTPA misrepresentation or DTPA unconscionability, all have the same causation requirement, that he's got to show if he had planted a different seed that he would have gotten a better crop. So certainly it's factual.
Well, but the difference is, his argument is, even if the arbitration problem bars me from some of these causes of action, I still have a right to maintain and pursue to a judgment, if I can, a DTPX action.
And I suggest not under the language of the statute, because 64002 says anyone who's claiming to be damaged by the failure of seed to produce or perform is represented as represented by warranty or by label. Now, certainly he is
or
such a person.
What?
As represented by warranty,
warranty
or label.
Label, okay, all
yes.
Right.
Certainly he is such a person. Certainly he made that claim. And our position is the only way he could have avoided the effect of the statute is not to make any claim along those lines at all. We say all of his claims.
Well, but he's made a statutory claim under the DTPA under one or two or three laundry list items.
Correct.
Would you agree that the DTPA was passed by the legislature to furnish consumers with causes of action against manufacturers and others where they would otherwise not have them?
But there is no exception in the Seed Arbitration Act for DTPA.
Why does there have to be when we know the purpose of the DTPA?
Well, because I think the comprehensive nature, it says to maintain a legal action, and I would certainly
think... But this is a
think,
statutory action. Not a common law.
Well, again, 64002 doesn't say to maintain a common law action or a statutory action. I certainly read it as any legal action.
But the language says certain. Then over on the notice on the package, it says certain legal actions.
Yes.
Why would they have said that if they didn't mean for something to still be out there?
Well, I think that there certainly may be some legal actions. This is not, I'll admit that 64002 is not all-encompassing. It concerns every claim that could relate to seed in any way. But I say first that it, regardless of how you dress them up or what causes of action you plead them under, it relates to all of his claims, or at least they're all intertwined together.
Any other questions?
Well, okay, so you're basically saying that it's not a prerequisite to all suits, but to some suits?
It's not a prerequisite to all suits having anything to do with seed. What it says is, if a purchaser of seeds has to go under the Act, if he claims to have been damaged by the failure of seed to produce or perform, is represented by warranty or label. I say that covers all of his claims, but certainly if there's some that it doesn't cover, they're intertwined.
Anything else? Thank you, counsel. That concludes today's oral arguments. The marshal will adjourn the court.
All right. Oh, yay, the Honorable Supreme Court has been adjourned.